Hey, Jabber fans, I regret to inform you that the audio in this episode is going to be terrible. I started my recording device without checking which input it was coming through, and it recorded off my built-in speaker microphones on my computer instead of my Blue Yeti mic that I normally use. So, everything on my end on this podcast episode is going to sound like it was recorded through tin can and string, unlike the other episodes, which normally sound acceptably mediocre. This is going to sound pretty terrible, but the episode itself has good content. We review movies, we make jokes, we do all the things we normally do, so hopefully, in spite of my terrible audio, you can still enjoy what we have here. Thanks for listening. Welcome to another episode of Jabber on the Drum, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. You are the co-host from San Diego, Keith Foster.
You are the co-host from Los Angeles, California. Cassidy Robinson is your name.
Thank you. Today we're going to be reviewing M. Night Shyamalan's Glass. And at the end of the program, for our Netflix homework, we're going to talk about The Long Assigned, The Last Dragon.
Barry Gordy's The Last Dragon.
Yes, Barry Gordy's The Last Dragon. I still haven't figured out who Barry Gordy is in all of this.
He was an executive producer, it said in the credits.
We're kind of sliding into 2019 now. We're doing 2019 land. We're here. We're doing it.
All right. I guess. Yeah.
You guess. Do you want to just get into the consume obey? Because I've ran out of things to say.
Yes. I don't. Were you trying? Like, were you going for content there?
I don't know. I was just kind of talking until I didn't have anything left, and it happened a lot faster than I thought it would.
Yeah. I just like. You weren't even vamping. You were just, you just like immediately gave up. You were like, this is the podcast. It's a new year. And maybe kill yourself. I don't know.
Let's do it. Consume Obey. What are you watching? What are you reading? What are we listening to? What are we obsessed with?
Ashley and I just finished the miniseries American Crime Story, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. The Ryan Murphy produced thing, his sort of most grounded project to date.
It's like a follow-up to the OJ thing, right?
Yeah. And it's a solid follow-up. It was really good. The guy who plays Andrew Cunanan, he just won the Golden Globe, and we were like, oh, we heard about this coming out. We were curious because we really liked the OJ one. So we decided to check it out, and it's real good.
Is it though?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm a little hesitant of the whole Ryan Murphy thing. Especially when he's covering actual things that happened.
I mean, yes, there are moments of creative liberty that you can kind of tell. It's kind of like, I don't know about that, but right. I don't know if that was real. But honestly, I think it's good that it's based in reality somewhat, because it's like, you know, it's very easy to sort of fact check these stories. And so I think it keeps it a little more grounded than some of his other stuff. Like stylistically, it's great.
Okay.
Same with the OJ one. So I actually think of all the Ryan Murphy stuff I've seen, the American Crime Story stuff has been the most interesting to me because it's like, you know, true crime reenactments, but with like Hollywood level budgets and actors.
Right. But it doesn't feel like TV movie of the week.
No, not at all. Stuff. Not at all. Like it's sort of weird because I know it's a true story and obviously it plays out the way it plays out. But I was like kind of sad. I was like, oh, I could have like done an like gone for another season of this.
Do you remember back in the 90s when Danny DeVito hosted Saturday Night Live and there was that sketch about the TV movie of the week version of the Joey Buttafuoco story?
Yes, I do. I don't.
That's all I see in my head whenever when I hear about the Ryan Murphy true crime things.
No. I mean there's obviously an added level of drama. It is meant to be entertaining and engrossing. But no, I genuinely really enjoyed it. I thought it was very engrossing, and there's a lot of San Diego connections I didn't realize.
Okay. So
that was really fun too. Like the guy who kills Versace was from San Diego originally, which I didn't know. So, there's a lot of like, him sort of blurring the San Diego gay scene. I don't know. It was weird to see like real gay bars in a show.
Oh, that are still open and people can go to.
Yeah. Yeah.
They use actual locations. They don't like, make sets.
At least the exterior shot was real. They might have made like an interior set, but
sure.
Yeah.
Well, kind of along the same lines, and I think I'm maybe the last person to bring this up. Against my better judgment, I started watching Surviving R. Kelly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it premiered on Lifetime, but there are ways you can watch it online. I think if you have a cable subscription at home, you can log in through your cable subscription on Lifetime.com and watch the episodes there. But it is depressing.
Oh yeah, I've heard some of the some of the breakdown of like kind of what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, honestly, it's no surprise to me. It's sort of a surprise. It's like it took.
It's a surprise that it's a surprise. Yeah.
Yeah, it was
no.
Like,
yeah, well, it was kind of like an open secret. Like it's always been out there. It's just everyone just keeps putting it on the back burner. Like everyone's like, oh well, I don't know. I guess that he got acquitted or something. I don't know. Like he's still making music, so it must have not been that bad.
Yeah,
no, it is. It's horrible. It's the worst thing ever.
And this was sort of like pre-Me Too, so, you know, so it was like...
Right, exactly.
There's not as much
attention. And it was kind of one of those things... It was one of those things where, like, there was no such thing as bad press.
Yeah.
Like, it just kind of made you more famous in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And there was... Yeah, there was kind of a... even something like the Chappelle Show's coverage of it... which was funny at the time, and you know, Chappelle's a comedic genius and all that, but like kind of made light of a pretty serious situation. And
but you could also
I'm not saying he shouldn't have done the sketch or that he did it the wrong way or anything.
I'm just gonna make
the argument. I'm just saying the focus of Chappelle's parody video, the Piss on You video, was a lot more piss focused on what happened and a lot less pedophile focused.
Sure. Well, I think a couple things. First of all, I think at the time it was a lot easier to ignore and people were a lot more comfortable ignoring things, which I am glad that we're getting away from as a society, as a culture. I'm glad that we're saying, you know, this bad behavior isn't acceptable. Now, also, you know, you could make the case that yes, it was a lot more piss focused, but it still was calling attention to this behavior. Not to the level that it should have. You know, it's certainly no Hannibal Buress's Cosby joke. Right. But you know, he was still talking about it when no one else was.
No, yeah. And credit to him. And R. Kelly was no fan of that sketch, believe me. But anyway, I don't know if I can even really recommend it. I mean, it's a well done docuseries, and it's a kind of tabloidy in a way. Like, they're kind of playing it both ways in the show. They're definitely drawing real seriousness to the situation and giving a voice to the voiceless and all of that, and that's great. But some of the editing choices and stuff are a little cheesy.
Sure, yeah.
It gets kind of extra. Mm-hmm. But it's a tough watch, and it's cases have been reopened and stuff like that. So it did a good thing, a good public service. I'm four episodes in, and it's exhausting. Every episode, I'm like, Jesus.
Oh yeah, yeah. I bet. Like, I kind of like, I've just read things about it, and I'm like, I think that's enough for me. I don't know. Like, I've never really been an R. Kelly fan. It was one of those things that, like, you know, I was kind of peripherally aware of, and now that I'm more aware of them, I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'm glad I'm not invested in that.
Believe me, it's not something I would have sought out exactly, except for I kept hearing about it so much. I was like, all right, I guess I have to check this out. And now I have to finish it because I'm so far into it.
Yeah, I think maybe as a palate cleanser, you should check out some Assassination of Gianni Versace. On a lighter note, why don't we hit some movie news?
Movie news. Talk about that movie news.
Yeah, let's do that. And we can start on this story, which I posted a while back. Barry Jenkins, director of If Beale Street Could Talk and Moonlight, says he's interested in making a large-scale sci-fi movie. He says here, I think now I want to grow aesthetically. I would like to do a sci-fi film, he said. Noting that he's a fan of space-obsessed director Denis Villeneuve, he says, I love cinema of all different scales and would love to play on that scale someday. You do you, Barry Jenkins.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Full disclosure, I haven't seen Moonlight or If Beale Street Could Talk. So, you know, I do understand that both of those movies, critically are pretty well acclaimed. And personally, I am a lot more interested in sci-fi just as a genre. And I don't know. I always think it's exciting when directors are like, especially when they get a little heat and they're like, I want to try this other thing. So I say, cool. I'm interested in it.
Yeah, I am too. I actually think that for the most part, genre films are usually better when you bring in somebody who just has a love of cinema generally.
For sure.
Like, it's not they didn't get into it because they wanted to make a decapitation film or, you know, they wanted to come in and make the best zombie movie ever. They got into film because they love film. Yeah. And then they make their way to genre because of this, that, or the other reason. I mean, let's be real. He probably wants to make a little money.
Yeah.
Those Moonlight checks are not running the mansion.
For sure. And especially when a movie like Black Panther
does as well as it does.
Yeah. With the historical precedent of the super black cast, black director, like, I can see why that would definitely be appealing. And I think there's plenty of room in that genre for more voices. So I said, bring it on.
Yeah, bring it on, all or nothing. Yeah, I'm down. I'm down for it. I think Barry Jenkins, beyond, you know, representation and all of that kind of stuff, I think just objectively, he's a great filmmaker. Sure. And I think that his attention to detail and his sensitivity when it comes to dealing with a scene and dealing with actors is very uniquely powerful. And I would love to see that kind of filmmaking approach to genre.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Cool. What is the next story here?
The next one I have is Craig Brewer to direct Eddie Murphy in Coming to America 2.
Finally.
Are you being real?
Not exactly. I'm being facetious. Who's clamoring for Coming to America 2?
I actually think more people than you'd expect.
It's a well-liked movie. It's kind of a classic 80s comedy.
Yeah, right? and it's, you know, it's one of Eddie Murphy's more notable roles when Eddie Murphy was the king of the fucking world. And I think...
That's like peak Eddie Murphy, like that and...
And here's the thing.
And Beverly Hills Cop.
Everyone wants an Eddie Murphy comeback. Everyone. Everyone wants it. Eddie Murphy wants it. The public wants it. Everyone wants an Eddie Murphy comeback. We want fun, the playful Eddie. He's similar to Adam Sandler in that way that his, like, he went from this youthful energy to being the best comedian in the fucking world to sliding into these hack ass movies.
Right.
And everyone wants to see him bounce back from that. Everyone wants to see him do comedy again, like just stand up comedy. And so I think, you know, maybe him returning to a role, like Coming to America is such a good opportunity for that. Like, I feel like the dominoes are set up for him to have his comeback. I think it's cool. I'm actually genuinely kind of excited. I hope it goes well. I hope they get a good scriptwriter, and I hope that he can do it kind of with no ego, and just try to do the fucking best he can. Because everyone knows he still has it in him. It's just,
well, okay. I think that's a theory. I think
a lot of people think that
he has it in him. I'm not so certain that he does, because Eddie Murphy from 1985 is
sure,
like, that's 33 years ago. I think that some people have a hot streak. And some people have a time and place moment, and that doesn't necessarily translate to every generation, every new comedic movement. Now, I'm not poo-pooing this, actually.
No, I get what you're saying. I think a talent like Eddie Murphy's, it doesn't just disappear. I think he made a lot of bad choices. There's so much that goes into making a movie, and at the time, I think he maybe had too many yes men saying, oh yeah, you know, this is funny. Kind of similar to Adam Sandler. Like,
right.
I don't think necessarily he had the right people behind him. And this is just a theory. You know, you're right. It could be that it was just like the right time, right place for him.
I think he's talented. I'm not saying that he never was talented. And we've seen him, you know, kind of have moments like in Dreamgirls and that kind of stuff where he almost had a comeback.
I know.
But it seems like there is something like innately in him, like his creative muse is to do these ridiculous comedies where he plays 8 characters and 5 of them in fat suits.
I know. I'm hoping this is sort of the movie that reignites his fire. And I think a lot of people are hoping that. So
here's why I'm excited about this story.
Okay.
I like Craig Brewer. I think he's a cool director who never quite received his just rewards for his level of talent coming right out of the gate with Hustle and Flow, which was a big deal that year. And then kind of more of a cult success with Black Snake Moan, which I think is a really good movie. Super underrated. And then he wanted to continue making like those kind of auteur things, and Hollywood changed on him. And all of a sudden it was, you know, what franchise can you be attached to? And he's just not that guy. So he, you know, he made the Footloose remake, which was much better than it should have been. But that's, you know, certainly didn't do much for his name as a creative person. And this probably wouldn't either, but I think if you're gonna do as bad of an idea as doing a sequel to Coming to America, Craig Brewer can probably deliver the best version of your bad idea.
See, I don't think it's a bad idea. I think that, like I said, I think the potential is there for this to be really hot. Maybe people of a younger generation aren't going to recognize it for the source material, and that's fine. Right. As long as it's a good movie that can stand on its own. If it's a good movie that can stand on its own, then I'm calling an Eddie Murphy comeback. I think this could be the one. I hope it is.
All right.
I mean, Eddie Murphy's still young enough. He still has...
Yeah, he still has a few good years. He can have like an autumnal, you know, era in his career where he started doing interesting stuff. We'll see what happens. Yeah. All right, let's get to this last story, because I think there's more to say about it. Jason Reitman, son of Ivan Reitman, is going to helm a direct Ghostbusters sequel set in the original canon of Ghostbusters 1 and 2. So, disregarding Paul Feig's Ghostbusters from 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So, this was kind of a big announcement.
Yeah, and then like immediately, like the next day, he released that little like 30-second teaser thing, where it like shows the Ecto-1, right?
I didn't see that. Here's the thing, but sure.
Oh, I mean, it's not much. It's like the definition of a teaser. But right. I like the tone of it. You know, as a teaser, if it is sort of like meant to set up like what the tone of the movie's going to be, then I'm like, then, you know, it did its job. I mean, here's the thing. And Leslie Jones came out tweeting about, like, you know, how
she's not crazy about
sort of disrespectful it is or whatever. And here's the thing. The Paul Feig one was a turd. And it wasn't any of the women's fault. It was a bad script. It was a director who shouldn't have been on that project. It has nothing to do with the fact that they're women. It has everything to do with the fact that it was like a very cynical cash grab, not funny movie. So I think if they want to try to keep the franchise alive, which I'm like, I don't need the Ghostbusters franchise to be alive. You know, like the first one's great. The second one's, you know, okay. We don't need a Ghostbusters universe or whatever, but I do think it is interesting that Jason Reitman's doing it.
Right.
And I like that it's set in the original universe. One of my big complaints with the reboot was that it was a reboot. It was like this unnecessary thing where they were like trying to reboot the tone and the story. Mm-hmm. But they have to waste half the movie explaining rules that everybody already knows.
Right.
When like, if that had just been set in like this universe, so we could just get going with the adventure or whatever. I think that that script could have been a lot cleaner, and maybe they could have spent some more time on the actress's chemistry and characters and all that stuff, instead of trying to shove this Ghostbusters reboot down our throats so hard. So I think it's great that they're trying to pass the torch in a more traditional way. Jason Reitman grew up literally on the set of the first movie. So if anyone's going to know the sort of the tone, and I feel like if anyone's going to know what this movie should be, it should be Jason Reitman. So that is what excites me the most about it.
Yes, I agree. I agree with you there. I think that the, again, kind of like the Barry Jenkins thing, more so than the fact that he's Ivan Reitman's son.
Yeah.
And, you know,
he did his own thing.
He did his own thing. When he set himself out as a director, he didn't do a Ghostbusters movie. He didn't even make a Ghostbusters-esque movie. He didn't even do, like, comedies like the other Ivan Reitman movies. He made, you know, these kind of thoughtful, character-driven indie films and was really, really, really good at doing that. He has his own sensibility as a director, and you could argue all day long if that's the correct sensibility for Ghostbusters, but I think that he's a competent filmmaker, and it's not about, you know, sure, the novelty of, like, the son taking on his father's project is going to sell some tickets, and that's great or whatever, but I think more so I'm just excited that a good filmmaker is going to be attached to this.
Especially,
which isn't to say that Paul Feig is a terrible filmmaker, although I would argue that he's not as good as he's often celebrated as being. But I do think that he is more adept to making, you know, a comedy that has more depth.
Especially, like, if you look at the original Ghostbusters movies, they are a very high concept, right? But they're very character driven. Most of the movie is about, you know, Bill Murray sort of off the leash to create this really fun, charismatic character. And that is it exactly, is Jason Reitman is really good at developing characters and letting characters play out in interesting ways. And I think a high concept movie like Ghostbusters, that's what we need, is we need these characters to sort of ground the film and make it so that it's not just shoving every possible joke in. And I agree completely. Like, he has a good background as a filmmaker, not just as Ivan Reitman's son. But I think that's also going to help. You know, I think him being on that set is going to give him a closeness that he's going to want to not be messed up more than anybody else. Otherwise, why would he attempt it? You know, like, there's got to be a lot of pressure on something like that. But I'm excited for the fact that it's set in the original universe. I'm excited for the fact that it's Jason Reitman. I guess that there's talk that the characters, like, taking over might be teenagers or whatever. I don't care. You know,
I heard about that, and I actually think that's the way to go. I don't want to see Indiana Jones 4. Of old Ghostbusters complaining about their backs while they're catching ghosts.
Well, there might, like, be a little bit of that. I don't know.
I mean, I'm okay with, like, bringing in some of the characters to sort of be the pillars of the story, but I would like to see some new blood in there, and again, just make it its own thing. Don't just have it be Callback City.
I agree.
They could fall into that trap too.
Yeah, the nostalgia. I mean, I think even the reboot suffered from that a little bit, where it was like, we're going to reference Zool and stuff, but not earn it at all. And so I don't think it has anything to do, again, with the fact that it was an all-female cast. Think it just... that
project, on the record, Jabber and the Drone is pro-female cast.
I just think that project was kind of doomed from the start.
Yeah, it was a poorly conceived thing, and then on top of it, everybody involved just wasn't on the same page, and then on top of it, it had, you know, ridiculous marketing, and then attack from alt-right red pillars.
And so, I think Leslie Jones' anger is justified. I don't think she's right.
I can see why she's mad, but I'll say this. When I saw those articles being published first, saying that she was upset by it, I wanted to, like, like go through my computer screen and go, no, what are you doing? Like,
yeah,
why do you want to like bring down the rancor of horridness that you went through in 2016 all over
again? Yeah, for sure.
Like at this point, if I were her, especially, I mean the whole cast and everybody involved, but her especially, I would just want to put as much distance between me and that movie as humanly possible.
Yeah, and also like fucking delete Twitter. Everyone delete Twitter. It is a garbage app.
Yeah, as you've often stated. Okay.
Yeah, cool. 2019, well, still anti-Twitter.
I'm gonna have a new segment on the podcast called "Let's Dig Up Controversial Tweets That Keith Wrote." So I'm gonna go back in the Wayback Machine, find some 2009ers, and
you know what?
Light up the podcast.
You know what? I actually challenge you to do that. I've always been pretty conscious about that stuff. I've always been pretty like. Self-editing as far as like, mm-hmm. what I publish online. And like, honestly, I think that that was probably a big part of why I was never great at Twitter, was because I would, you know, like type out a draft and just never publish it and then look at it like a day later and delete it. Cause I was, mm-hmm. I always had that kind of idea in my head of like, well, anyone can see this and right. it's around forever. So honestly, kind of the people who are saying that's a decade-old tweet, I do get a little bit of like the, well, you're still the fucking idiot who put it out there in the world.
Right.
But, so, honestly, if you can find anything, bring it on. Actually, don't. Let's not play this game. I'm pretty sure that I'm okay, but I just don't want to go down that road.
All right, let's go ahead and get into the movie of the week. We're going to review M. Night Shyamalan's Glass. Do you want me to try and describe this thing?
I don't care. I don't think it's that out there.
No, it's not that difficult. So back in the... When did Unbreakable come out? 2001?
2002?
2000. So... M. Night Shyamalan made a film called Unbreakable back when he was still respected as being a filmmaker, which was sort of a postmodern take.
You're already loading this with some editorial.
That's fine. I'm just telling it like it is. So it was kind of a postmodern take on the superhero thing before there really was a superhero thing to comment on. The superhero genre, as we know it today, was still in its infancy. And that aspect of it sort of sneaks up on you, actually, as you're watching it. You kind of put it together like, oh, okay, you're like making a meta commentary on comic books. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. And kind of novel for the time. Fast forward through hills and valleys within M. Night Shyamalan's career.
Yeah.
Fast forward to 2016. And he does the movie Split with James McAvoy. And again, it's kind of an interesting take on sort of the serial killer kidnapper thriller. And it has some psychological edge to it. Like, it was a little bit of M. Night getting his game back. I wouldn't say it's an entirely a success, but it at least housed an interesting performance. And it had some attention to character and detail and some of the stuff that we remember liking about M. Night Shyamalan. He received a lot of critical acclaim, or maybe not critical acclaim, but at least some amount of acceptance back into the club again. I guess it was announced in the end credits of Split that this takes place in the same universe as his previous film, Unbreakable. Mm-hmm. So we saw coming a sort of collision of these two worlds, of these two films,
the twist of Split, spoiler if you haven't seen it, uh-huh. Is that it's actually sort of a sequel to Unbreakable. I mean, it doesn't have any direct connection other than, you know, like the very end there's a little Easter egg,
right?
But it is you know, it is in the same
movie universe.
So,
right.
Yeah, that's where this comes in, is like, now it's a direct sequel to both Unbreakable and Split.
The plot of Glass, named after Samuel L. Jackson's character from Unbreakable, Mr. Glass, is that James McAvoy's character, who is now goes by the name The Horde, multiple personalities, and one of his personalities can become super strong, is caught by Bruce Willis's character, David Dunn, who is also super strong, and they are taken away to the loony bin, where a psychologist is studying a weird phenomenon of people who think they're superheroes or supervillains, and is kind of trying to debunk that and treat it as a psychosis or some sort of pathology. We also find out that Mr. Glass, Samuel Jackson's character, Elijah Price, who caused hundreds or maybe thousands of deaths in his life trying to find superheroes, is also in the same facility, heavily medicated. Things go down, and we get a collision of super folk.
Yeah, okay. All right. So, how to sum up my feelings about Glass? Mm-hmm. How to sum them up? I was with this movie for the most part. For the most part, I really enjoyed this movie. I liked seeing Bruce Willis's character come back. I liked seeing James McAvoy's character and his crazy performance as a multifaceted personality disorder character come back. I liked seeing Samuel L. Jackson as Mr. Glass come back. I think that I think it was great that both, you know, all these characters sort of already had their sort of origin stories told. So if you're caught up with that world, you know, you already sort of have some idea of what these characters are capable of. So, you know, like James McAvoy's character, we don't get to spend as much time with his multiple personalities. But he didn't miss a beat with them. They're all still, you know, very fun to watch and to watch him sort of change. Although I am a little concerned that he's going to have a hernia. He's very veiny. I think the problem with this movie, and there is a definite problem with this movie, the problem with this movie is M. Night Shyamalan set up all these characters and all these pieces so well, and then once he got them all together, he just kind of doesn't know what to do with them. And I was so with this movie until the end, and then it's like, the problem was he was trying to do his M. Night Shyamalan, O. Henry twist around.
Right.
And it sort of cuts the legs out from under the movie.
Right.
And it's like, so what was the point again? And here's the thing. The ending wasn't so disappointing that it, like, ruins the movie. It just was like, I was so with it until the end, and it's like, oh, that's it? And then it just sort of, like, instead of it being, like, a huge disappointment, it just sort of lets the air out of the balloon. Like, it just sort of goes flat for me. It's like a soda that you're drinking that you're really enjoying, and eventually it just, like, all the carbonation's gone.
And then you have those last final gulps you have to just get.
Yeah, and you're like, all right, and you just get them down. But you know it could have been better.
I think you're being far more charitable than I'm going to be to this movie. I think this is pretty bad. I think this is not a good movie. I will say there's a chunk, maybe like 35 minutes in the middle, when it's them in the facility, and they're kind of, you know, they're being interrogated by Sarah Paulson's character, and she's talking about like the real world scenarios or the scientific reasons why they think they might be superheroes and kind of making them rethink that stuff.
Yeah, I think that's the problem. Is that, to me, that's where sort of the meat of the movie is them wrestling with these ideas of delusion of grandeur. And to me, that's where it gets really interesting. And it's just like he just sort of writes himself into a corner because the case he presents is like, well, yeah, of course, it's logical. And then it's like, well, ignore that. Like, you know, I think
Even if the movie is going to say that, no, you know, they're in fact they have super abilities and, you know, there's some need in our culture for heroes. And there was lots of conversations that could be had with the way that he had set this up. And we're having Paulson there, sort of the skeptic. You know, he even put sort of the critic's mouth in, or the critic's voice in her mouth. Good that he doesn't do that too much after seeing Lady in the Water. But, you know, there's things he can have, like these meta discussions, and he does for a little while. The problem is, he can't let a good thing go, and he doesn't know when the story is hitting traction. To him, that was set up to get to what he really wants to do, which is make this postmodern superhero movie, but he's not good at that. The fight choreography in this movie is horrendous. That should be the big payoff. We have two characters who are superpowered, who we've seen in these movies be able to do these incredible things. And then once they get together, all the fight scenes are shot in close-up.
The fight scenes didn't bother me.
You weren't paying attention to them then, because they're really, really bad. Like,
I didn't think so. Like,
you can't see a goddamn thing that's happening. It goes to a close-up camera shot of McAvoy's face, then it goes to a close-up camera shot of Bruce Willis's face, and then you get kind of a shot, like a kind of a establishing shot where they're mostly behind a van, and then it goes back to close-up again. It's like he's trying to hide the cuts because he doesn't know how to do choreography. So a movie that's ostensibly an action film doesn't know how to do action. That's a problem. On top of that, I think James McAvoy is still having a lot of fun with this character because he just did it, and he's still fresh in there. And then Samuel Jackson's having fun with his character because he's just a really, really fucking good actor, and he can tap into that easily. It's like, muscle memory for him. Yes. Bruce Willis is doing a comedic cameo version of his character here. He's sleepwalking through this movie.
I don't know. I think that's a little unfair. Because
he has nothing to do.
Well, yes, that's true. That's true. I don't know. I actually liked the
character first, who plays his son has more to do.
I think that's a script problem. I don't think that's a Bruce Willis problem, because I actually was enjoying like the first section of the movie before they're in the sanitarium where he was like, you know, had just embraced this vigilante lifestyle. But I mean, you know, I think that he has the hardest job because James McAvoy, you know, he has a very big character with a lot of stuff to do. Samuel Jackson has a very big villainous character. And, you know, David Dunn was always very
brooding and quiet.
And yeah, so.
And I get that, but I think year 2000 Bruce Willis is very different from year 2019 Bruce Willis as far as what he wants to do with an internal performance. Because let's be real, that you're going to get one or two kinds of performances from Bruce Willis. He's going to either be the brute or the brood. And here he doesn't really do either.
I don't know. I didn't have a problem with Bruce Willis. I did have a problem with how little sort of script he was given and how little, like, that was one of my big problems with the movie is, like, this movie doesn't have any of the emotional resonance of Unbreakable, and it doesn't have any of the
like, thriller aspect of it.
Of Split, because, like, that fucking scene from Unbreakable in the kitchen with the fucking gun is is such a good scene, you know, and there's, and the drama within that is so well done. And it's like, well, now that we've sort of explored that with this character, you know, he just didn't know what to do with him. He other than fight James McAvoy. I kind of see what you're saying.
This about is the biggest. Scene. This is the biggest problem with the movie. And you summed it up pretty well as far as like, you know, he puts these characters together and doesn't know what to do with them. That is true. This movie is so goddamn wordy. This is M. Night Shyamalan's one of his worst attempts of dealing with exposition, which he is like famously bad at. Like going all the way back to Lady in the Water Up. Sarah Paulson's character, her only role in the film is to explain things to the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's whole lot of it, including the themes of the movie, including the rules of this comic book world. When they start having these conversations about, like, oh, you know, these like Campbellian archetypes of the comic book characters while they're fighting, I just, like, sat there in my movie seat going, stop it.
Well, I can see you doing that, too.
If M. Night Shyamalan is going to continue making films, I want his next film to be a 40-minute silent film. I want to see if he can tell a story without literally telling the audience what every scene is about.
No, he can't. I mean, that was also my big complaint about Split. And I feel very similarly about this movie that I did about Split. Like I was entertained. I was invested. But to me, it misses the mark, because I think the big thing is he's way more interested in a story we're not seeing. And to me, that's where I get frustrated, because I'm not going to go into spoilers or like give his twists away, but he's definitely trying to have a twist, which is no, like annoying. just don't yeah. like just let it play out, right? Like can't we just see the payoff of what you set up for two movies? Do we really have to be building to another twist? So he's way more interested in that, and he just sort of throws all of this other stuff away that I was like, oh, well, why? And I will say that scene is really muddy, because everyone is there like for the big showdown at the end. And it's like
everyone, the big showdown takes place in a front yard.
That doesn't bother me. What bothers me is that like every character is there, but like most of them are just kind of standing around for a lot of it.
Yeah.
Like waiting for other characters to do things. So that bothers me more than the setting or any, like the setting I was fine, whatever.
Shot in daylight.
I don't care. That doesn't bother me. I didn't think it looked bad, because I wasn't ever really waiting for it to be an action film, because, you know, based off of what I'd seen in Split and Unbreakable, I was sort of expecting what I got as far as that goes. So that didn't bother me. What bothered me is you literally have characters standing around just like going, whoa, and that's dumb. So I think the problem with that sequence isn't the way the action's done. I think it's that it's literally, let's put all these characters together and have them not do anything. Like, why were they all there?
I'm not sure. But here's the thing. I wouldn't have expected a great action movie out of this if it had done other things. Like, when it for a little chunk there in the middle, when I was like, okay, movie, I think I see what you're trying to get at. When it was interesting, when it was more psychological, which I think Shyamalan does have some raw ability in being able to do psychological storytelling, but he gets so caught up in his world building and his rule making that he just gets so far away from the emotional stakes of the story. And it ends up becoming fan fiction of his own world.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I think that that's exactly the problem with this movie, is it's like, I just wanted to see these characters play out in a natural way. And it starts to, and then it's like, he's just so clearly not as interested in these characters as we are. And that's what's frustrating. Right. It's like, you spent all this time, you know, 16 years to set up this surprise sequel, mm-hmm. and then this is what you do with it? Like, come on.
Yeah. I'll also say, I think Anya Taylor-Joy is unnecessary as far as script. Her character doesn't need to be there. And wasted as an actress.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, I didn't care. I was like, sure, whatever. I agree that she is wasted, but I don't know. I did kind of think it was cool that they got like the main characters from each of those movies. I just wish that there was a reason for it, and that it
And then as far as the twist goes, I don't really know what he's trying to say about anything about all of this stuff. I don't want to get into it, but you know, ultimately when it comes down to like what the big ta-da is to all of this, I was just kind of left scratching my head and going, I guess.
Well,
that's not even the biggest problem with the movie, because even if it had led up to that, but I was interested up to that point, then that would have been fine. But I think this is a pretty messy, not good film.
I actually really liked it until the third act, until things are supposed to get exciting. I really enjoyed the first bit, like seeing how these characters came together. I enjoyed all the stuff in the sanitarium. It was just
that's definitely the best stuff in the movie, is that about 25 to 35 minutes right in the middle.
I liked the beginning too. I didn't think that was too, because that part was a lot less exposition-y. It was a lot just like sort of catching up with these characters. I do think that Sarah Paulson's character, I think Sarah Paulson was wasted as an actress, because she didn't have any real dramatic stuff to do. Like you said, she's just sort of an exposition machine, and then and then I think the twist sort of ruins the movie, because it's just like sort of shits on everything, and is like, okay, well, this was almost fun, and then it was like, oh, can't have that. and then the ending after sort of after the twist, I thought was dumb. I thought was straight up dumb. I was like, I think he could have achieved the same thing. I don't know if this is getting too spoilery. I think he could have achieved the same thing in a better way.
If I'm grading it, D plus.
Oh, really?
D plus.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I didn't hate it that much. I think I gave it like a B minus.
Wow.
I still really enjoyed it. I still enjoyed seeing the characters come together. I enjoyed it up till the ending, which just to me, like I said, was kind of a fart. It was like, I think had it been able to stick the landing, I would have really enjoyed it. But as it was just okay. So yeah, B minus.
All right. Let's go ahead and get into the Netflix homework then. And I'll have you describe to me the homework that you assigned me 4 or 5 weeks ago, The Last Dragon.
Okay. So this is a famous blaxploitation kung fu flick from the 80s. Bruce Leroy is this character who's obsessed with karate, the fetishization of martial arts. It has reached a level of training that he has to go. He wants to seek the next level He's become so good at his martial arts. His teacher, his sensei, tells him that only a true master can tell him how to reach the final level and achieve the glow, which is just sort of this undefined, mysterious kung fu power. He goes out on his adventure and in the process stumbles upon this woman who has a hit music video show. And she's being harassed. This is very 80s. And she's being harassed by this character, Eddie Arcadian, who's trying to get his girlfriend's video on the air. And so he keeps harassing her, and she sort of keeps getting saved by Bruce Leroy, who is also obsessed with Bruce Lee. While all this is going on, Shonuff, the Shogun of Harlem, is sort of terrorizing Bruce Leroy's family and just sort of Harlem in general, looking for an ultimate kung fu battle with Bruce Leroy.
You assigned this to me, and I had somehow never heard of this movie.
I'm surprised you've never heard of this. This is...
Have you?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes? This is... I mean, it's a pretty famous movie. It's pretty famous, especially in black culture.
Sure.
You know, this was Motown produced. But yeah, I've definitely heard of this movie. It's sort of a really famous cult, you know, kung fu blaxploitation flick. Like, I don't know how to sum it up better than that.
I mean, that's what it is. That's very much what it is. It's very campy. It's, you know, very much a product of its time. And, you know, kind of has like the influence of sort of the MTV music business culture, because that's a big part of the story. But also like Rhythm of the Night, and there's like actual songs that like got on the radio. So I don't know if they were already hits.
Well, like before. I said, I noticed that it was, you know, like a Motown produced thing. So I'm assuming that.
So they probably had access to music that they could use.
Yeah. I'm also wondering if like, you know, if it sort of the soundtrack was maybe more, you know, bigger hit than the movie. I don't know. But yeah, there's some great music in here.
Yeah, and lots of sequences of music. It's almost a musical.
Kind of. Yeah. A musical kung fu blaxploitation flick.
Right. And in that kind of the Apple and Phantom of the Paradise sort of way, music culture and I guess record executives and like that kind of stuff plays its way into this otherwise goofy genre plot. And it's, you know, meant to be enjoyed, I think, ironically, or probably wasn't meant to be enjoyed ironically at the time. Although I think maybe so, because it like this is a little past the
I mean, this is 85. You know,
this is 85. So this would have been, this is like, you know, blaxploitation at its peak was like 71 through 74.
Yeah, I think this movie's pretty self-aware. Like, it's pretty funny. It, you know, like the Eddie Arcadian's girlfriend, what's her name, Angela. You know, and she like is this obvious like wants to be Cyndi Lauper or Madonna, kind of like kind of pop star. You know, but they also definitely are sort of poking fun at that type
the
of
over the top pop
trends at the time. Production. I thought this movie was a damn delight. I had a blast with it.
I did too. Like from scene one, I was like, okay, here we go.
Yeah, it's so I think it's intentionally campy. It's really like I said, it's I think a lot funnier than it probably had to be.
Right. And again, there's kind of a mix here of intentionally funny, because I do think that they're like it's sort of looking back at the Blaxploitation era. It's not just fully participating in it. It is aware of a Blaxploitation being a thing.
Yeah, I think especially with like the character Shonuff.
Right, and all of that stuff. And the Jive Talk and all that stuff. Like, all of that was, like, pretty over by this point. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, and then there's also definitely the ninja craze of the 80s and a post-Karate Kid thing going on here.
Yeah.
Because 84 Karate Kid came out, so this would be a year after that. So they're definitely sort of capitalizing on that. And then on top of it, there's kind of this MTV culture thing happening all over it. So it's kind of the perfect confluence of, like, quality cheese.
Yeah, it honestly kind of, this is what a fucking Iron Fist show on Netflix should have been. Like, this sort of...
Iron Fist, yes. I was thinking, I thought you were going to say Kung Fury, because it kind of was this, but go ahead.
No, Iron Fist. Like, I think, I think if you're going to have any kind of Kung Fu, or, like I said, fetishization of Kung Fu, like, you should be self-aware enough to kind of poke fun of it, too.
Right.
You know, like, it kind of reminds me of the Ninja Turtles movie at times. You know, it literally is a guy who has to achieve the next power level so that he can glow a golden glow. Like, he fucking goes Super Saiyan in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, that, and it's great. Came from something.
And it's fucking great. Like, I was genuinely, like, that scene, I knew it was coming, but it's genuinely, I think, very exciting. Like, when Shonuff starts glowing red, I was like, oh, fuck. You fuck, Leroy. You know, like, I was getting into it. It's just like, and that giant kung fu battle with, like, all of his students fighting these, like, professional hired murderers that Eddie Arcadian is bringing to get revenge because he dunked him in a fish tank.
Yeah.
Like, it's insane.
And also, we have a small, but very noticeable William H. Macy cameo in the movie.
Yeah, a baby. A baby H. Macy. William H. Baby.
Shows up for a scene. I mean, it is what it is. I liked it a lot. If you like intentionally cheesy movies, this is a good way to go. This is like a good kind of like background at a party kind of movie.
Oh, like yeah.
You have people over, you want something that's kind of, that people can kind of like, if they happen to be on the couch talking, they can pay attention to for a few minutes and get a good chuckle out of. But it doesn't, nobody has to like, you know, pay serious attention to it. Or
no.
If it is playing at like a midnight show or something like that, you could definitely take some friends and have a really good time.
I think I can also see, like, I bet it's also, I think, a very quotable movie.
I didn't know this, but when I Wikipedia'd it, apparently Tessa Thompson's character quotes this movie in Sorry to Bother You, my favorite film of 2018.
Interesting. I mean, that does not surprise me at all. My friend Toya, this is like her favorite movie. That's kind of why I was interested in it, because I'd never seen it before. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Thumbs up. I'll say that.
I think if you're into this kind of thing, and I know for a fact you are, so I had a feeling this would be a fun one.
It's never boring.
No. Exactly. And it keeps it fun in all the right ways. Like, I even loved the little brother.
He's like, great in the movie. He's like, that's like a genuinely good comedic performance.
Yeah, he's like
this, he's way committed and like totally commanding every scene. Like, he's actually like really good in the movie.
I would say he's my favorite non kung fu fighting character.
Yeah, yeah. I also like the hip hop guys who work at the Fortune Cookie Factory.
Oh yeah! Oh my God! Yeah,
they're a lot of fun.
They're so great, mm-hmm. And even his friend at the like the dojo who doesn't right, know yeah. karate,
who can't fight. Yeah,
yeah.
He's an Asian guy who doesn't know karate. Yeah,
even though at the end he totally does, but whatever.
Right.
But that's sort of the logic that this movie runs on.
Right. It's a heightened reality.
For sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, there's that. Next week for the Netflix homework, I'm going to have us watch the Netflix version of the Fyre Festival catastrophe titled Fyre, the Greatest Party That Never Happened. I know that there is also a Hulu version that launched at the same time. I've heard mixed things about both.
I think we should watch both. I think we should fucking watch both. I know it's a Netflix homework, but unless that's like a mini-series or some shit. Is it just like a movie?
I think they're just documentaries. Yeah, both ones. Yeah, Maybe we could do it. We'll try that. We'll try and watch both. I have access to Netflix or Hulu, as it were. So maybe we'll try and watch both the Netflix and the Hulu Fyre documentaries.
Yeah, it's just it's just a one movie, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's an hour and a half. All right.
And maybe we'll contrast and compare for our Netflix homework next week. So that'll be otherwise. That is the end of the episode. And if anybody has anything to say about any of the topics we discussed here, you can email us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play and Player.fm. You can follow us on Twitter at Jabber Podcast, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Jabber Podcast and on Instagram at Jabber Podcast. You can follow me individually at VC Cassidy on Twitter, and you can also read my movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal over at theidahostatejournal.com movies or something. It's over there.
Yeah, you can check out my website at www.keithfosterkid.com, where I keep I just updated my show calendar. I've been doing a lot of stuff at Old Town Improv Companies, got some more shows coming up. The last few have been really good. I have another Alt Comedia show this Friday, January 25th. And then the next weekend, I'm back at Improv versus Stand-Up, which is we get some stand-up comedians. They do their sets, and then we do improv based off of those. The last couple shows have been a blast. They've just been really fun to come to. I was a little afraid these would be shit shows, but I've been having a lot of fun with them. So, yeah, that's going to be like a bi-weekly show. So like February 1st is our next one, and then February 15th. I have Book Club. Book Club, we just did our first swashbuckling adventure. We have two more coming up on February 2nd and February 16th. I'm really excited about this genre. The show was also a lot of fun. So come check out some shows sometime. They've been great. All these shows are pretty much at 9 p.m., I pretty much only do the late shows there. So, yeah, come check them out. You can also follow me on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid, and you can follow me on Twitter at Keith Foster Kid, except I don't tweet anymore, and Twitter's garbage. But maybe if I get enough followers, that could convince me to come back on, but it won't.
So. Ooh, you're leaving the door open. Go check out our friends out there who are also doing their own podcasts, including Dennis and Patrick over at Almost Educational. I just did an episode with Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums podcast where we discussed Sunny Day Real Estate's Diary, a record I've been listening to since I was in high school. So I had a lot to say about that. It was a fun episode to record with those guys. They are consummate professionals. Apparently, I didn't know this till I was talking to them after the show was over, but they had the members of Right Said Fred do an episode with them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's fucking cool.
Yeah, to talk about, I think, a Sinatra album or something like that. So I'm going to have to go back and listen to that one. But you should also listen to my episode about Sunny Day Real Estate because I have a lot to say about that. You can also check out Mike Fallick over at Hack Thought and Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places and Rogue Fun, a Star Wars podcast.
Also check out our friend Adam Connie at the Adamant Podcast. Adam is actually going to be on my next Alt-Comedia show this Friday, January 25th. So that should be really fun. But check out his podcast, the Adamant Podcast. And check out our friends Merrill and Bo at Campfire Shit Show.
All right. And with that, we will see you next week.
Kiss my Converse.